Golf Smarter Premium, number 499, published on July 28, 2015. Golf is 100% mental and 100% physical with author of Mental Rules for Golf, Dr. Greg Steinberg.
This is Golf Smarter Premium. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome to the Golf Smarter Podcast, Greg.
Hey, Fred. Thanks for having me on. I always appreciate talking about the mental game of golf and life. So it's always exciting to share some of the stuff I've learned.
Well, that's interesting that you put it in golf and life. There's so many times that people will say, why do people compare golf to life? And I, of course, everyone has their own answers, and I'm sure you do too. Well, how do you answer that question?
I'd say golf is life. No, I'd say, you know, when I say it, I really mean that the principles in terms of having a strong mental game apply to life and business. It's the same principles. So that how you build confidence, how you stay focused, how you remain calm, those same principles not only apply on the golf course, but they apply in business, they apply in parenting, they apply when you're playing a musical instrument, they apply in this scholastic setting. It's all the same stuff.
Well, you know, my answer to the question when asked before about why do people say golf is like life, my response is it's because both of them are just a series of disasters that you, and it's how you handle yourself beyond that.
Yeah, I mean, the reason why golf is like life in that regard is that, yes, we have we always get bad breaks on the golf course, and we get a lot of good breaks, and that's the way life works. And if you're prepared emotionally and mentally for bad breaks, then you're going to perform your best. It's difficult to remain confident when you make a mistake. It's difficult to remain confident in life when you make a mistake. And we're always nervous. You know, the way the human condition works is if something's important to you, you're going to be nervous. And so therefore, when you play golf in front of your friends or in a tournament, you're going to be nervous. Well, if you go speak to an important client, you're going to be nervous. And the way you deal with your anxiety is going to be the same way on the golf course as it is in the boardroom.
Let me talk about my anxiety for a moment, because next week I have the privilege of playing in a pro-am on the web.com tour. I'm very excited about it, but I'm also getting fairly anxious. I'm trying to play as much golf as I can before I get out there, but I'm going to be playing alongside of a pro. Now, I'll take some of the control over because I'm going to have a recorder and even a camera with me. So during our round, which I think is a best ball, so why should I be nervous? During our round, I'll be recording an interview for an upcoming podcast. But I still feel some sort of intimidation of playing next to a pro. Help!
Yeah, well, let me first say the pro doesn't care how bad or good you play. He good cares point. If he, I think a lot of the pros do care in terms of helping you, and they'll probably give you tips, but ultimately they don't really care. We care how we play, but you have to remember that they don't care. And it's the same thing with your friends. When you play with your friends, they don't really care if you're playing well or poorly. You care much more than they do. And that's a big eye opener. And when you realize that, it frees you up. You know, sometimes we're our worst enemy and sometimes we're our best friend. And you have to always work it out in your mind to be your best friend and not your worst enemy. You know, the nerves come from this fear of demonstrating incompetence. And we're always afraid of not living up to our potential, of not playing up to our potential. And that fear creates all those nerves and the butterflies and the muscle tension. When you let go of that ego, I might say, and just free it up and allow yourself to enjoy the moment, be in the process, not care what other people are thinking of you, you let go of the ego, and usually we play our best golf.
Excellent point. Excellent point. I frequently will have situations where I'm getting to talk to somebody that I've just met or, you know, I've not played golf with before. And we get into a conversation about golf. I mentioned that I've been doing this podcast for almost 10 years and that my game has improved by the interviews that I've done, obviously. And then when I invite the person, it's like, oh, well, would you like to play golf? And they're like, you know, I'm not that good. I'm like, I don't care. You're absolutely right. I don't care. That's not why we're going out there. Unless you want to play for money, which I don't, That's fine with me. I'm just going out there because I love to take the walk. I love being outdoors, and I think we would have fun together.
Yeah, the old saying is when you meet a person at the party and you ask them about their handicap, they'll tell you there are two. But when you meet them on the first tee, they'll tell you there are 10.
Yes, indeed.
So it always works that way.
It really does. It really does. Well, let's get to you a little more now. Let's talk about your credibility. Beyond the fact that I've seen you on the Golf Channel and Dancing with the Stars, what gets you to become a golf? Are you a golf psychologist or a mental game coach? What is specifically your title beyond professor, and how'd you get there?
Well, I am a professor of sports psychology, and you might say golf psychologist because I've worked with numerous golf teams. I've worked with numerous amateurs. I've worked with many PGA players. Ultimately, what I do is I apply the principles of performance, the principles of psychology to the golf area. And I play golf myself. I play competitive golf. Love golf. Been playing for 30 years. And so if I have a client, let's say on the PGA Tour, the web.com tour, and they call me and they want me to work with them, they fly to Nashville where I live and I work with them one-on-one because I can see so much more on the golf course than I can if I just ask them questions. Perfect example is I was working with Bob Wolcott. He was on the PGA Tour and he wanted to get back on the tour in his mid-40s. And so we went out and played. Now, Bob's a good old boy, kind of, you know, laid back, and his personality matched his routine for his full swing. But when he got over his chipping and putting, it was really quick. And he struggled with his chip and his putting. And I would have never seen that if, just through questions. So that's why I always basically want to work with players on the golf course. And I think it's real important, as an example with Bob Wolcott, that you match your personality, your routine, to your personality. And people don't appreciate that. So if they're kind of laid back, really kind of casual, their routine needs to be laid back and casual. If they're kind of maybe more in your face and assertive, then you need a routine to kind of match your personality. A routine is essential. That's one of the key ingredients that I work with players. And a great routine, what they do is a routine helps you develop rhythm, helps you develop a reactive mind, helps you to get into the feel zone. And when you have those three things, it mentally and emotionally prepares you for the event at hand, which is the shot.
How is it that you're able to look at somebody's game like that and watching them not having difficulty with their short game, with their chipping and stuff, and how do you stay on the mental side of that and avoid the mechanics?
Well, you know, I get that question a lot. I don't try to do mechanics because that's not my shtick. I was a golf instructor for 10 years, so I get that, but I really try to avoid that. And there's some overlap, but ultimately what I'm doing is I'm focusing on their mental game and their emotional game, not working on the mechanics. Of course, it bleeds into the mechanics sometimes. So, you know, if I'm working with a young player and they're blocking it way right all day long, I might say to them, okay, I want you to visualize a fade and feel a fade and now try to hit a fade. I don't tell them how to hit a fade. I want them to feel it and visualize it. That's more the mental game, and that's how I work it in. And so the idea is that I stay away from the, you might say, the mechanical part, and really work on the mental and emotional game. Now, you could say that the same thing with a teaching pro. A lot of times they work on the mechanics, but they also have to talk a little bit about the mental game. If they don't, they're not really doing their best job. So it goes hand in hand. People always ask me, is the mental game 50% mental, 70% mental? Well, I like to refer to what Yogi Berra has said. Remember Yogi Berra, the famous manager and catcher, and he has these quips, these famous quips. The great one is, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. He also said, you must go to all your friends' funerals so they come to yours. Now, I don't know how that works, but he said that. But he said baseball was 90% mental and the other 50% was hitting. Now, again, that's fuzzy math, but I would say golf is 100% mental, 100% physical. You can't tease one from the other. Because when you're playing well, you're thinking well. And when you're thinking well, you're playing well. On the flip side, when you're playing bad, you're thinking poorly. So the idea is that in many cases, when we play bad, we only think it's the physical side. But really, a lot of times, it comes with the mental side. It comes with maybe we were nervous and it sped up our swing. And that's why we hooked it way left. But here's the issue. A lot of people know how to work on their physical game, but they don't know how to work on their mental game. And that's really what I do, is I give them strategies to work on their mental game.
I like it. I also love the line that you just had. That may be the title of today's show, which is golf is 100% mental and 100% physical. It's a great line. Thank you.
It's true.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to talk about, you know, as a professor, what is your curriculum? And I don't necessarily like to ask two questions at once, but are your students psychology majors or are they athletes?
Well, it's both. I get a lot of psychology majors. I get athletes. My department, Health and Human Performance, many of the students go on to teach and coach. So we talk about principles of psychology, but ultimately it's about not only sport, but it relates to scholastic, you know, getting better grades. It relates to music. And again, it goes back to that the principles that you speak about relate to life. Now, you change your nomenclature or your lingo, and it might apply to golf or tennis or music. But ultimately, if it's a principle, a true principle, in my opinion, it relates to golf. It relates to business. It relates to music. It relates to parenting. It relates to everything.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. Can we talk more about the different personalities that you've identified on the golf course and how their routines fit for each personality and the definition of what the personalities are?
Yeah, I don't really get into personality profiles because everybody's unique. If you look at a Peyton Manning and a Tom Brady, amazing quarterbacks, totally different personalities. How can you say one personality is better than another? What I do is I try to figure out their strengths, their attitudes, their goals, and apply the techniques that I have for their specific personality. I don't get into that personality profile stuff because to me, it doesn't matter what your personality is. It matters making your game better within your personality structure. And it's hard to explain, but I know Bob Rotella has said this many times, is that sports psychology is an art and a science. So the science part is, you know, I've studied it for 35 years. I know the mechanics. I know the tools. But the art part is being intuitive to get a feel for that player right away. And based on that intuitiveness, I basically can mold my strategies for their personality. Now, that's a little vague. But as a listener, what you're really trying to do is everybody has their own strengths. Everybody has certain weaknesses. You want to enhance your strengths. And really, you don't even need to work on your weaknesses unless it's really affecting you. But if it's affecting you, you need to work on your weaknesses. But I always enhance their strengths. So, for instance, if a player is confident, we might work on developing greater confidence through self-talk, through imagery, through managing their emotions. And if they lack confidence, then we work on that. But in some instances, you know, confidence doesn't always hurt you. Sometimes it helps you in terms of lack of it, because I've had players say that when they have a bad day on the range, they always have a great day on the golf course. And a lot of times it relates to expectations, you know. So what I always get a feel for is that player and really what their needs are versus a personality dimension, because to me, a personality dimension doesn't mean anything. Because if you look at a Phil Mickelson versus, let's say, a Tiger Woods, they have different personalities, but they've had amazing careers. So why do I care about their personality? I only care, like, for instance, Phil Mickelson, he's more of a, we might say, gambling personality, high risk, as, you know, we all know some of the issues that have come out. So he's at his best when he's in a high-risk situation. He has to go for broke. He has to be confident when he's in that high-risk situation. That's when he's playing his best. That's what turns him on. So for me, I would enhance that principle with him.
You know, it's interesting because I know that personally, when I started focusing on my weaknesses on the golf course, my game got better. As opposed to
because they were hurting you.
Yes.
You know, there's an old saying, it's a new saying in psychology. When you focus on your weaknesses, it drains you. And the only issue is if your weaknesses don't drain you, here's an example in life. You're a leader. You see the big picture. You hate the details. You hate the little minutia in your life. So you get an assistant to work on the minutia, because if you focused on the minutia, it would drain you. Now, going to golf, if your short game is a weakness, you have to work on your short game. So, you know, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the weaknesses that don't hurt you.
Are you a fan of Dr. Joe Parent, Zen Golf, and other sports psychologists that have that's not a fair question to ask if you're a fan. Let's call it more a student of what they profess, like Rotella and Joe Parent. And there's so many that have even been on the podcast.
There's a lot of people out there. I mean, everybody has their own opinion. You listen to what they say and you take it. It's kind of like reading golf instruction. You need a tree, okay? And when someone makes like a Peter Costas makes a good point, you put it on your tree of knowledge. So when Bob Rotella makes a good point, I put it on my tree of knowledge, but I need a foundation. So I have my own foundation. And then when I read stuff, I put it on my own personal tree. If you don't have a main foundation, then it's just kind of like bricks in the brickyard and it gets confusing.
Yeah, well, everybody has their own opinion, sure, but you're a professor, so you have to look at it differently. You're also a teacher to classroom sizes.
I'll tell you my main opinion is that it's not about the mental game. It's not about your thinking. It's not about your behaviors. It's about your emotions. When you master your emotions, you master your world. Your thinking and your behavior help you to control your emotions. But it's only about your emotions out there. So confidence is an emotion. Being calm is an emotion. Basically, it's your emotions that affect your performance the most. And so I always talk about emotional toughness. Mental toughness is kind of this catch-all phrase, but it's all about emotion. So what I do when I speak with an athlete is always about controlling their emotions out there. And the first step is to be aware. You have to be aware of why you're nervous, what nervousness feels like to you, or why you're confident, why you have been confident in the past, and then ultimately learn what I call primers. Primers are words, actions, and images to control your emotions. So the idea is this. It's what I call an emotional toughness triad. The first step is being emotionally aware. The second step is creating primers, which are words, actions, or images, or really stimuli, which control your emotions. And the third step is creating positive, powerful habits. And the idea is that we go to our habits under pressure. So the reason why people get too nervous is because their habit is incorrect. The reason why a Tiger Woods or a Phil Mickelson or a Jordan Spieth can play their best under pressure is because their habit is correct. They get more focused. They get calmer under pressure. And the idea is when you have these positive, powerful habits, you ultimately play your best under pressure. I call it the squeeze. If you think about an orange, if I squeeze this orange, what comes out? Orange juice, right? If you squeezed it, what comes out? Orange juice. Orange juice always comes out of an orange. The second question is, what have you put in the orange? If you put in negativity, if you put in fear, if you put in doubt, that will come out when you get squeezed. And squeezed is the pressure. And we all get squeezed in life and on the golf course. So the idea is that if you put in confidence, if you put in peace of mind, if you put in complete focus and emotional engagement, when you get squeezed, that comes out under pressure. And so I try to put in the right juice for my players, because everybody gets squeezed. All the players can play great on Thursday. It's how well they do on Sunday that really matters. That's when they feel squeezed. When an amateur feels squeezed, it's when he's playing with his buddies for, you know, the $2 Nassau or the club championship. It's not when he's playing by himself. But when you play, when it's really how well you play when you get squeezed that matters.
What have you found to be the difference between the amateur and the pro as far as that self-imposed pressure?
Well, it's always self-imposed because, you know, unless you're playing for, you know, $1 million, which is, you know, there's pressure to keep your card. It's always self-imposed. But the idea is it's the same. The amateurs feel the pressure as well as the pros. That's why they choke on Sunday, because they feel that pressure. And they have not developed the right emotional habits. If they had, they would play better. Now, here's the perfect example. Tiger Woods, when he was in his heyday from, let's say, 97 to 2008, he had the right emotional habits. So under pressure, when he got squeezed, he played his best. Now, for whatever reason, you can call it, you know, all the difficulties he had with his family life and his, you know, his now he's playing poorly. His emotional habit is incorrect. And so when he gets squeezed, he plays terribly now.
I hate to kick a guy when he's been kicked enough, but I'd love to go back to the 2015 U.S. Open at Chambers Bay and what happened to Dustin Johnson. When he was approaching the green and he's on in two and he's got a 12, 15-foot putt to win the U.S. Open, what did you see in him and what did you anticipate happening?
Well, I didn't, you know, it's interesting. If you look at Dustin Johnson, he's a great example of anxiety. Anxiety does not affect our big muscles, which is our swing, right? That's why he can make beautiful swings. He was by far the best ball striker that tournament at the U.S. Open. But his putting was a little suspect, if you notice coming down the stretch. Anxiety affects our small muscles, which is our fingers and our hands. So he was definitely a little nervous, and it affected him. I didn't see anything walking down the stretch, you know, and he made an okay putt on the first putt and it went by, you know, and he said he didn't, you know, really choke on the putt coming back. You know, I'm going to give it to him, whatever. All I know is that it's interesting to note that anxiety did not affect his swing, but affected his short game. And that's a great lesson for amateurs, is that anxiety will not necessarily affect your swing, but it's going to affect your short game much. When you get squeezed, it definitely affects your putting and chipping much more.
And what do you think of the makeup of this 22 now that he's officially 22 years old, Jordan Spieth? What do you, you know, I don't know if you've been out there with him, if you've met these guys, or you're just watching on TV like the rest of us. What do you witness? What do you take notes of?
Well, if you can bottle what he has, you know, you'd be a multimillionaire. I mean, he has what Tiger Woods had, which is he wants to take the last shot. He wants all the pressure. He loves the pressure. You know, that's the difference. The players that play successfully, doesn't matter what sport it is, they want the last shot. They want all the pressure. They thrive in that. The ones that are fearful, you know, about making a mistake under pressure, those are the ones that don't perform well under pressure. So Jordan Spieth is the guy that wants all the limelight, he wants all the attention, and he wants to show his stuff under pressure, same way Tiger Woods is, you know. The ones that, you know, you can say a guy like David Duval, he didn't like that pressure, and it basically made him choke, and he, you know, ruined his game. You know, Ian Baker Finch, same kind of thing. The difference is they all have talent. They all have immense talent, these guys and ladies on tour. It's the ones that love the pressure. I mean, truly love the pressure and want to show off their skills to the world are the ones that thrive.
But Spieth doesn't come across as arrogant, though. You know, like that confidence, he doesn't seem so boastful. It's really remarkable.
I guarantee you he's the most confident person in the world, but he's been, I'm not going to say trained. You know, he seems like a really nice young man. He's been trained to be more humble. And I'm sure he is humble in the sense that not to be boastful, but I guarantee you if you talked to him one-on-one, took off the recorder and said, look, hey, just tell me what you think, he would come off extremely confident. To me, there's a difference between arrogant and confidence. The best players in the world are extremely confident. Arrogance means that you think you know everything and you don't have to listen to anybody. Confidence means you're great and you believe in your greatness, but you also believe you can learn things. And so the greatest players are extremely confident, but they also know they're not the smartest person in the room and they can learn from you. An arrogant person believes he's the smartest person in the room and he can't learn anything from anybody.
Or the arrogant one to me is the guy who is the smartest person in the room, believes he's the smartest person in the room, and wants to tell everybody he's the smartest person in the room.
Well, that can be true too. But you know what? Once you believe you're not the smartest person in the room, you become the smartest person in the room in the essence that you're learning from people now. You know, it's all about learning from other people that make you smarter.
One more person that had an interesting time at the U.S. Open this year. You wrote about him in a blog post a while back. It was Jason Day, and you were talking about visualization. And I'm now curious to hear what you think about, was it all visualization, or is he just trying to keep the vertigo in check? Do you see something different now than when you first wrote that?
Yeah, I mean, you don't know how... you could tell it totally impacted him at the Open. And it was, you know, the Saturday he played, he shot 68 on Saturday. Amazing. It affected him more on Sunday. So it was an amazing story. It would have been amazing if he won. You know, he's a great player. And he has all the skill set, yet he hasn't won, you know, a major yet. So it's kind of interesting to see it play out for him. With his visualization, what you can see is before he hits every shot, he closes his eyes and he visualizes the shot he wants to hit. It's just a great lesson for listeners in that visualization creates feel. Feel creates you to be in the reactive state. And once you're in the reactive state, you're going to play your best. So the greater the visualization you have, the greater your feel. The greater your feel, the greater you're going to perform under pressure.
Can you give us a little bit more on visualization and how we can bring it to the forefront of our game and how we can do it?
Well, I mean, just take putting. What most people do is they might pick a spot, but I tell everybody to visualize the arc and actually visualize the arc past the hole so the hole gets in the way of the arc. And then when you take your practice swings, all you're trying to do when you putt is to keep the ball in the arc. So that's how it creates feel. So people that have struggled with feel is because they're not visualizing enough. So if you visualize the arc, take your practice swings to feel the ball stay in the arc, and then take your putt exactly with that feel, you're going to make more putts. Same thing with chipping or putting. I'm sorry, pitching. So when people chip, they're told to visualize the spot to chip to. No, you visualize the trajectory of landing to that spot. You also visualize as the ball's rolling how fast it's going to roll and then the arc it's going to take. And so the more visualization you have, the greater feel you're going to have. So it's all about feel. So like in the full swing, if you visualize a fade and then make some practice swings for a fade, you're going to probably you're more likely to hit a fade than a hook because you've kind of created this mindset.
And then there's the fact of losing focus. Usually would start right after a bad putt. Now, a putt that ends up 3 inches or 1 inch short of the hole or just to the left or just to the right, it's not going to ruin your day. It'll be frustrating. But one that blows by the hole, you know, 10, 15 feet, that can send you into a downward spiral that can really hurt for the entire round. How do we get our focus back? How do we avoid losing focus for that?
Well, going back to that statement, it only sets you in a downward spiral if you choose to do that. I tell everybody, you know, confidence is a choice. You can choose to be confident no matter how bad you're playing. And if you are confident, you're going to most likely play better. It's always a choice to lose your confidence. It's a choice to lose your focus. You know, the idea is going back to Tom Watson, 1982, I think it was the seventh hole. He missed like a 3-foot putt at the U.S. Open at Pebble Beach. And he said, all great players make bad putts. He chose to make to keep his confidence. He made a bad stroke, made a bogey, yet he said, hey, I'm still a great putter. And of course, we know what happened. He won the U.S. Open in 82. You can make a couple bad putts and still say, hey, I'm a great putter. I'm going to make some bad putts here and there. And that's the way it is. You know, the idea is that if you blow something by a putt by 10 feet, really, you just lost your focus. All you have to do is say to yourself, let's get our focus back. And we're back on the wagon. And the idea is that it's easy to do that by choice. You know, when you make a couple bad putts and say, oh, I'm a terrible putter, I'm stinking today. You know, I'm always a bad putter under pressure. Then more likely than not, you're going to be a bad putter. So a lot of times this engagement into, what we call focus has a lot to do with your choice and what you say to yourself.
Frequently when I'm playing with somebody and they'll have a bad shot. And it's mostly not a bad swing. It's just a bad result. And they'll start beating themselves up and they'll say, oh, and they like Tiger, you hear them say, oh, Tiger, right? You know, and your friend out there, and he's like, oh, Steve, what are you doing? I generally use my own, generally do not use my name when I'm beating myself up on a round of golf. But I find myself laughing at myself when something, you know, like my comment will be, you know, the result is nothing that I can do, but I didn't like the swing, or I thought that was a great swing. I'm sorry, the result. But like on a putt that rolls by 10 feet, I'll just start laughing at myself. Trying to keep myself together.
Yeah, those are, let me make two comments. The first comment is, we know in psychology now, in terms of self-talk, if you use your name, it's better. Like, Greg, you can do a better job, or Greg, you're a great putter, instead of you can do it. Using your name actually works better, because it's kind of like you're your friend talking to yourself. And that's why it works. Now, the other way, it probably works
worse.
Can
I change my name?
If you say, Greg, you stink, it probably makes you lose confidence. They didn't do research in the negative. They just did research in the positive. Going back to the second point was, I'm trying to remember what the question was.
Just laughing.
I'm sorry, laughing. Okay.
No, that's okay.
So if you look at a Phil Mickelson, I've written this before. He has a release. When he makes a bad shot, he smiles, you know? And we need a release to let go of that let's say, negative energy. Otherwise, you carry that negative energy with you. I tell my players, I call it a post-shot routine. In a post-shot routine, they have 3 seconds to figure out what they did wrong. So they analyze what they did wrong. And then the next thing, that's the release. Then they basically image the swing they want, which I call the re-image. And then they make the swing they actually wanted to do, and then they say to themselves, next shot. So the idea is, if you analyze what you did wrong, it's a lot easier to let it go. Otherwise, if you don't kind of think about what you did wrong, you kind of carry that baggage with you. So you have a release, you re-image, you do the shot you wanted, like, you know, kind of like just a practice swing with the way you wanted. So for instance, let's say you think you got too quick at the top. Okay, then you image yourself kind of slow transition at the top. You make the swing, the practice swing, with a slower transition, and then you say next shot, and it's over.
Great advice. Thank you very much. One more thing that I want to, and again, it was based on reading some of your blog posts. I can't wait to read the book. And that'd be poor decision making. On the golf course, I had a round last week. I was playing up in the Sierras, which I don't usually play up at 7,000 feet. And so I was, as I usually do, I'll just club up a little bit, and I was overshooting the green a couple times, which sometimes feels great, but not generally. But it's more about what I kept saying to myself is, that was just poor decision making. I just made a bad choice on that shot. So you've talked about the inner caddy, and I'd like to pursue the inner caddy.
Fire your inner caddy there. You know, that's a good way to do it. You said, I made a good swing, poor choice, because here's the thing. You can control your choices. Your choices change, and therefore you believe success is around the corner. So you know that the next hole, you're going to make a better choice. Anytime we blame it on ability or things that we believe are more stable, then we believe success is not around the corner. Failure will continue. So for instance, if you are putting poorly and you believe you're a bad putter, then the next hole, you're going to believe you're a bad putter. But if you believe things like, I made a good stroke, but it hit that spike mark, the next hole, you know, their spike mark is probably not going to ruin the roll. Therefore, you keep your confidence.
All right, can you do me a favor and a little self-promotion? How about letting us know where to get the book, name of the books, and your website?
Yeah, okay. So my website is drgregsteinberg.com. So it's D-R-G-R-E-G-G Steinberg, S-T-E-I-N-B-E-R-G.com. I have Mental Rules for Golf on the website. I have a book about business called Full Throttle, and I have a parenting book called Flying Lessons, which teaches parents how to build mental and emotional toughness in their kids. And then I have CDs and DVDs and things like that. And they can reach out to me in terms of questions. My email will be on there and all that good stuff.
And that's very good stuff. Thank you. So I need to make a couple of announcements here on the show, but I don't want to let you go yet. Before we go, I'd like to get a tip from you after my announcements. I'd like to get a tip from you referring back to something that we talked about earlier, and you talked about these small muscles on putting, and I'd like a tip on how to release that anxiety. Could we do that?
Sure.
Couple of quick updates. A few episodes ago, I mentioned that we're doing weekly emails that provide links to our latest videos, some of the show closing tips, and other interesting golf tidbits out there and videos that we have. If you want to be included on that list, please send me an email to fred@golfsmarterpodcast.com, and I'll put you on the list. But before you write to me, do me a quick favor. Check your spam filter first. You may already be on our list. You're just not aware that you're receiving them. I've received a couple of emails from people going, oops, sorry, I guess I am on your list. and I'm glad, but check your email because you're missing some good content if you have not been receiving them. Now, if you're paying attention, which you don't have to do, but our next episode is number 500. That's a milestone in the golf, in the podcast world, especially when you're only doing it once a week. And we originally scheduled to share our live show from Paradise Valley Estates that was recorded last week. But then I checked the PGA Tour schedule, and it makes much more sense to have our expert PGA gamblers back on to provide their picks and misses for the upcoming PGA Championship at Whistling Straits. I wanted to make sure that that show gets published before the PGA Championship, not afterwards. So our own Tiger and Bubba, they have to remain anonymous, Tiger and Bubba will come back, hopefully both of them. And they've made some pretty impressive predictions so far on the two majors that we've covered, the U.S. Open and the Open Championship. And if you were paying attention, you could have won a lot of money if you followed their advice. So don't miss next week's episode to get the lowdown on your investment tips. And now, have you heard that we're giving away a pair of Ben Hogan Golf TK15 scoring wedges to four lucky winners? That's right. Four people are going to win. Well, let's talk about gapping for a moment. Now, bending a wedge to something it wasn't designed to be also compromises its bounce and offset. So the ultimate commitment to the precision Mr. Hogan demanded drove the all-new Ben Hogan Golf Company to build every loft from 48 to 63 degrees. This allows every golfer to put together the exact set of 3 to 4 wedges that will optimize their distance gapping and prime scoring range and blend to fit their iron lofts, whether those irons are Ben Hogan's or not. So when you win our drawing and get to choose which two of the TK15 wedges you can get, Ben Hogan Golf recommends starting your set with the true pitching wedge of 48 to 51 degrees. This is the club that Mr. Hogan's competitors dubbed the Equalizer, and it will quickly become one of your favorite go-to clubs. Actually, I just received my new Ben Hogan set of irons and wedges the other day, and I am chomping at the bit to get to the driving range with them. But my club fitter and I decided to put grips on them that I've been playing for a while instead of the grips that they provided, which they had no problem doing. They put the grips in the box. They just were not attached. So each of these clubs arrived gripless. And, oh, here's something really neat. When I went to the club fitter to deliver the box, the local Ping rep was there showcasing some of his new products. And he put one of the Ben Hogan Fort Worth 15 irons in his hand. And he inspected it very, very closely. And his eyebrows were just kept going up and up and up. Finally, after a couple of minutes, he just looked at me and said, "These are really beautiful. And they even look a lot like an updated version of the old Ben Hogan Apex irons," which is quite a compliment. Now, only Ben Hogan Golf allows you to fully custom fit your wedges to you, to your game, and to your irons, regardless of what brand you play. So to register for our random drawing, click on the Ben Hogan link in today's show notes or go to benhogangolf.com/golfsmarter. Deadline to enter is Monday, August 17th at midnight Pacific time. and will announce all four winners on the show of August 18th. You must provide a continental U.S. mailing address to be eligible to win, and each of our four winners will get a free pair of Ben Hogan Golf TK15 wedges custom fit to their specifications. The complimentary Hogan Fit personal bag mapping analysis will show you how your wedges should be configured for optimum scoring. So, after you fill out the entry form, spend some time on the Ben Hogan site to learn more about the TK15 wedges and the Fort Worth 15 irons exclusively made by Terry Kaler's team at Ben Hogan Golf. Again, register to win at benhogangolf.com/golfsmarter. And good luck. And now here's Dr. Greg Steinberg of Mental Rules for Golf on how to release your anxiety on the putting green.
Anxiety affects our smaller muscles more than our big muscles. Big muscles relate to the swing. Small muscles relate to putting and chipping, fingers and our hands. And so if you feel like you get nervous, a lot of times it affects our chipping and putting more so than our swing. So if you're like that, one of the best things you can do is do a routine that releases your anxiety. So what I tell my players is take some deep breaths, because you'd be surprised. Just taking two or three deep breaths will release your anxiety. And then I would shrug my shoulders once or twice, because you can. That will really free up your anxiety. You can even shake your hands a little bit and basically and make a positive self-statement like, Greg, make a good stroke here. Greg, you're going to make this putt. It just allows us to kind of give us more confidence, because the more confident we are, the less anxiety we will be. So ultimately, take some deep breaths at the start of your routine, shrug your shoulders and say, I'm going to make a great stroke here. And boom, get over the putt, look at it a couple times, and then make your stroke.